The men cheered him wildly, even though the first gabion was instantly submerged, and only a whirlpool on the river's surface marked its position. Another filled gabion lay ready. The front ender waddled up to it, lowered its steel arms, and picked it up as tenderly as a mother gathering up her infant. Nicholas shouted at the foreman to get their gangs back to work. The long lines of men came up the valley, naked except for their brief white loincloths. Sweating heavily in the heat of the gorge, their skin glistened like anthracite freshly cut from the coalface. Each of them carried on his head a basket of stone aggregate, which he dumped into the mouth of the waiting gabion. Then he returned with his empty basket down the hill to the quarry. As each gabion was filled, another team fitted the mesh lid and laced it closed with heavy 8-gauge wire. $20 bonus to the team with the most baskets filled today, Nicholas bellowed. They shouted with glee and redoubled their efforts, but they were unable to keep up with Sapper on the front ender. He laid his stone piers artfully, working out from the shallow water alongside the bank so that each gabion lay against its neighbour, keying into the wall to give mutual support. At first there was little evidence of progress, but as a solid reef was built up beneath the surface, the river began to react savagely. The voice of the water changed from a low rustle to a dull roar as it tore at Sapper's wall. Soon the top of the wall of gabions thrust its head above the surface, and the river was constricted to half its former width. Now its mood was truculent. It poured through the gap in a solid green torrent, and crept almost imperceptibly up the banks as it was forced to back up behind the barrier. The river worried the foundations of the dam, clawing at it to find its weak spots, and the progress of the work slowed down as the waters rose higher. Up in the riverine forests along the banks, the axemen were at work, and Nicholas winced each time one of the great trees toppled, groaning and shrieking like a living creature. He liked to think of himself as a conservationist, and some of these trees had taken centuries to reach this girth. "Do you want your bleeding dam or your pretty trees?" Sapper demanded ferociously, when Nicholas lamented in his hearing. Nicholas turned away without replying. And they were all becoming tired with the unremitting labour. Their nerves were stretching towards snapping point, and tempers were mercurial. Already there had been a number of murderous fights amongst the workmen, and each time Nicholas had been forced to duck in under the swinging steel mattocks to break it up and separate the combatants. Slowly they squeezed the river in its bed as the pier crept out from the bank, and the time came when they had to transfer their efforts to the far bank. It required the combined efforts of their entire labour force to build a new road along the bank as far as the ford. There they manhandled the front ender into the water, and with 100 men hauling on the tow ropes and her tall, lugged rear wheels spinning and churning the surface to a froth, they dragged her across. Then they had to build another road back along the far bank to reach the dam site. They cut out the tree trunks that obstructed them and levered the boulders out of the way to get the tractor through. Once they had her back at the dam site, they could begin the same process of laying out gabions from the far bank. Gradually, a few metres each day, the two walls crept closer to each other, and as the gap between them narrowed, the water rose higher and became more raucous, making the work more difficult. In the meanwhile, 200 metres upstream of the dam site, the falcons and the scorpions were at work. These two teams were building the raft of tree trunks that they had hacked from the forest. The timbers were lashed together to form a grating. Over this was laid heavy PVC sheeting to make it waterproof. Then a second grating of tree trunks went over this to form a gigantic sandwich. It was all lashed together with heavy baling wire. Finally, one end of the grating was ballasted with boulders. Sapper arranged the ballast of boulders to make the raft one-sided heavy, so that it would float almost vertically in the water, with one end of it scraping the bottom of the river and the other sticking up above the surface. The dimensions of the completed raft were carefully related to the gap between the two buttresses of the dam. and while the work on the raft and the wall continued, Sapper built up a stockpile of filled gabions, which he stacked on both banks below the dam. Three other full work teams, the elephants, the buffaloes and the rhinos, comprising the biggest and strongest men in the force, laboured at the head of the valley. They were digging out a deep canal into which the river could be diverted. "Your hotshot engineer Taeta never thought of that little refinement," Sapper gloated to Rayan, as they stood on the lip of the trench. "What it means is that we only have to raise the level of the river another 6 feet before it will start flowing down the canal and into the valley. Without it, we would have had to lift the water almost 20 feet to divert it." "Perhaps the river levels were different 4,000 years ago." Rayan felt a strange loyalty to the long-dead Egyptian, and she defended him. "Or perhaps he dug a canal, but all traces of it have been obliterated." "Not bleeding likely," Sapper grunted. "The little perisher just plain didn't think of it." His expression was smug and self-satisfied. "One up on Mr. Taeta, I think." Rayan smiled to herself. It was strange how even the practical and down-to-earth Sapper felt that this was a direct personal challenge from down the ages. He, too, had been caught up in Taeta's game. By dint of neither threat nor heavenly reward could the monks be persuaded into working on Sundays. Each Saturday evening they knocked off an hour earlier and trooped away down the valley on the trail to the monastery, so as to be in time for Holy Communion the next day. Although Nicholas grumbled and scowled at their desertion, secretly he was as relieved as any of them for the chance to rest. They were all exhausted, and for once there would be no chanting of matins to wake them at 4 o'clock the next morning. So on Saturday night they all swore to each other that they would sleep late the next morning. But from force of habit, Nicholas found himself awake and fully alert at the same iniquitous hour. He could not stay in his camp bed, and when he came back from his ablutions at the riverside, he found that Rayan had also been awake and was dressed. "Coffee?" She lifted the pot off the fire and poured a mugful for him. "I slept terribly badly last night," she admitted. "I had the most ridiculous dreams. I found myself in Mimosa's tomb, lost in a labyrinth of passages. I was searching for the burial chamber, opening doors, but there were always people in the rooms that I looked into. Duryad was working in one room, and he looked up and he said, 'Remember the protocol of the four bulls. Start at the beginning.' He was so real and alive, I wanted to go to him. But the door closed in my face, and I knew I'd never see him again." Tears filled her eyes and glistened in the light of the campfire. Nicholas sought to distract her from the painful memory. "Who were in the other rooms?" he asked. "In the next room was Nahut Gudabi." He laughed spitefully and said, "The jackal chases the sun," and his head changed into the head of Anubis, the jackal god of the cemetery, and he yelped and barked. I was so frightened that I ran. She sipped her coffee. It was all meaningless and silly. But Von Schiller was in the next room, and he rose in the air and flapped his wings and said, "The vulture rises and the stone falls." And I hated him so much I wanted to strike him, but then he was gone. "And then you woke up?" Nicholas suggested. "No, there was one other room." "Who was in it?" She dropped her eyes and her voice was small. "You were," she said. "Me? What did I say?" he smiled. "You didn't say anything," she whispered, and blushed so suddenly and fiercely that he was instantly intrigued. "What did I do then?" He was still smiling. "Nothing. I mean, I can't tell you." The dream returned to her, vivid and real as life. Every detail of his naked body, even the smell and the feel of him, she forced herself to stop thinking about it. She felt vulnerable as she had been in the dream. "Tell me about it," he insisted. "No." She stood up quickly, confused and still blushing, trying to thrust the images from her. Last night had been the first time in her life that she had ever dreamed of a man in that way, the first time she had ever experienced a full orgasm in her sleep. This morning, when she awoke, she found that she had soaked right through her pyjamas. "We have a full day ahead of us with no work to do," she blurted, the first thought that came into her mind. "On the contrary," he stood up with her, "we will have to make the arrangements for getting out of here. When the time comes, we will probably be in something of a hurry.
Mind if I tag along? She asked. Two teams, the buffaloes and the elephants, with only their foreman missing, were waiting for them at the quarry. They comprised 60 of the strongest men in the labour force. Nicholas unpacked the inflatable Avon rafts from one of the pallets. Each raft was deflated and folded into a neat pack with the paddles strapped along the sides. These craft had been specifically designed for river running in turbulent water, and each was capable of carrying 16 crew and a ton of cargo. He directed them to strap the heavy packs onto the carrying poles that they had cut for that purpose. Five men on each end of the long poles, with the bundle of the boat slung in the centre, made light of the load. They set off at a cracking pace down the trail, and as soon as one team tired, the next was ready to take over. They made the exchange without even stopping, the new porters slipping their shoulders under the pole on the run, while the exhausted team dropped out. Nicholas carried the radio in its shock-proof and waterproof fiberglass case. He would not trust such a precious instrument to one of the porters. He and Royan trotted along behind the caravan, joining in the chorus of the work chant that the porters sang as they carried their loads down to the monastery. Mima Tema was waiting on the terrace outside the church of St. Frumentius to welcome them. He led them down the staircase hewn out of the rock of the cliff, 200 feet to the very water's edge. There was a narrow rocky ledge against which the Nile waters dashed, and the spray from the high waterfalls drifted over them like a perpetual drizzle of rain. After the heat and the bright sunlight above, it was cold and gloomy and dank down there in the depths of the gorge. The black cliffs ran with water, and the ledge on which they stood was wet and slippery underfoot. Ryan shivered as she watched the river running by, forming a great spinning vortex as it swirled around the deep rock bowl and then raced out through the narrow throat of the gorge on its long, hectic journey towards Egypt and the north.
"If only I had known that this was the road you were planning on taking home."
She eyed the river dubiously.
"If you'd prefer to walk, it's okay by me," Nicholas told her. "With luck, we'll be carrying some extra baggage. The river is the logical escape route."
"I suppose it makes sense, but still it's not terribly inviting." She broke off a piece of driftwood from a stranded tangle that lay trapped upon the ledge and tossed it into the river. It was whipped away and raced over the standing wave where some submerged obstacle forced the surface to bulge up.
"What speed is that current?" she asked in a subdued voice as the splinter of driftwood was sucked below the surface.
"Oh, not much more than 8 or 9 knots," he told her offhandedly. "But that's nothing. The river is still very low. Just wait until it starts raining up in the mountains. Then you will really see some water passing through here. It would be great fun. Lots of people would pay good money for the chance to run a river like this. You're going to love it."
"Thanks," she said dryly. "I can't wait."
50 feet above the ledge, out of reach of the Nile's highest water level, was a small cavern, the Epiphany Shrine. Long ago, the monks had cut this passage deeply into the rock face, and it ended in a spacious candle-lit chamber that housed a life-sized statue of the Virgin, dressed in faded velvet robes with the infant in her arms. Mima Tema gave them his sanction to store the rafts in the shrine, and they stacked them against a sidewall. When the porters had left, Nicholas showed Royan how to operate the quick-release handles on the packs and the CO2 cylinders which would inflate the rafts within minutes. He wrapped the radio case and his small emergency pack in a sheet of plastic and stowed them in one of the boat packs where he could lay his hands on them again in a hurry.
You do intend coming along on this joyride?" she asked anxiously. You aren't planning on sending me down on my ownsome?"
"It's best that you know how it all works," he told her. "If things start to get a little hairy when the time comes to leave here, I may need your help in launching the rafts." When they climbed back up the staircase into the warmth and the sunlight, Royan's uncertain mood had changed.
"It's not yet noon, and we have the rest of the day to ourselves. Let's go back to Taita's pool again," she suggested.
And he shrugged indulgently.
The buffaloes and the elephants accompanied them as far as the branch in the trail. Here the teams headed back towards the dam, and shouted and hallooed their farewells after Nicholas and Royanne.